From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
What's this story about in your mind?
Just what it's like to be the most talked about writer in the country.
The film The End of the Tour is based on the conversations between writer David Foster Wallace and Rolling Stone reporter David Lipsky. Today we listen back to my 1997 interview with the late David Foster Wallace.
I have a very weird and amateur sense that an enormous part of like my generation and the generation right after mine is just an extremely sad sort of lost generation, which when you think about the material comforts and the political freedoms that we enjoy is just strange.
Also, we'll feature my 2009 interview with Jason Segel, who portrays David Foster Wallace in the film. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Show Me a Hero, the new HBO miniseries by David Simon, the creator of The Wire and Tremé. That's coming up on Fresh Air. Before we get back to Fresh Air, here's another podcast you might enjoy, the TED Radio Hour. You'll hear discussions about fascinating ideas, amazing inventions, fresh approaches to old problems, and new ways to think and create. You can find the TED Radio Hour podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. The writer David Foster Wallace was suspicious of fame, other people's and his own. But he allowed Rolling Stone reporter David Lipsky to spend 5 days interviewing him and traveling with him in the final days of Wallace's 1996 book tour promoting his novel Infinite Jest. Those 5 days are the subject of the new film The End of the Tour, starring Jason Segel as Wallace and Jesse Eisenberg as Lipsky. We're going to hear an interview I recorded with David Foster Wallace in 1997. In 2008, at the age of 46, he hanged himself. Looking back on his work, New York Times book critic Michiko Kakutani described Wallace as having used his prodigious gifts as a writer, his manic, exuberant prose, his ferocious powers of observation, his ability to fuse avant-garde techniques with old-fashioned moral seriousness, to create a series of strobe-lit portraits of a millennial America overdosing on the drugs of entertainment and self-gratification. Before we hear what he had to say on Fresh Air, let's listen to a clip from the film. This is shortly after Lipsky has arrived at Wallace's secluded home in Bloomington, Illinois. Lipsky has just turned on his tape recorder to begin the interview.
Listen, before we start putting stuff on tape, I need to ask you something. I need to know that anything that I say 5 minutes later not to put in, that you're not going to put in.
Absolutely.
Just given my level of fatigue and my up quotient lately, it's the only way I can see doing it and not going crazy.
Nope, I completely understand.
It's right back on, huh?
You agreed to the interview.
When I spoke with David Foster Wallace, his book Infinite Jest had just been published in paperback, and he had a new collection of essays called A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again, about the luxury cruise he was asked to write about for Harper's Magazine. The cruise ads promised exciting adventures and entertainment to fill every moment of the day. He wrote, "It's as if they were trying to convince you that you are guaranteed of having a good time because the cruise personnel will micromanage every pleasure option, and your troublesome capacities for choice, error, regret, dissatisfaction, and despair will be removed from the equation." Do you think that when people are on vacation, they worry that they're not making the right choice in what they're doing and they're not having as much fun as other people on vacation are having? And then when you have the day managed for you, you can just relax because the professionals are handling it for you.
I think that's probably true. And I think that there's a weird kind of paradox that the more expensive the vacation is, the more potentially anxiety-producing it is. And that's why I think, you know, the paradox is that a great deal of the expense of a luxury cruise, other than the facilities, is this entire battalion of professional fund managers going around. And a big part of their job is to assure you that you're having a good time. And their smiles were very high watt, and they were constantly sort of inviting people up to the microphone to give sort of almost evangelical testimony to what a good time they were having.
You're right. There's something about a mass market luxury cruise that's unbearably sad. What's sad about it?
Oh, boy. I think, now again, I'm not any kind of cruisologist, right? So I'm just a regular sort of civilian who is on this thing. I think that I notice the same kind of sadness whenever in my own life I know that there's hard stuff that I'm not dealing with. And so what happens is I'll jack it into fifth gear and begin moving so fast and doing so much and trying to experience so much that I'm really sort of trying to drown it out. What I really wanted, and Harper's didn't want to do it, was I really wanted to follow a couple cruisers back and see what the week after the cruise was like, because the brochures and the sort of mythology of cruising suggests that you return to the stresses of your normal life relaxed and refreshed. And at least in my own experience, you know, the cruise was so completely infantilizing and there was so little demanded of me that even just, you know, standing in a supermarket checkout line seemed like an unendurable ordeal afterwards.
You know, I really like the way you write about a pleasure and how difficult it can be to really achieve. You write about pleasure in The Infinite Jest, your latest novel. And I'm thinking, you know, one of the things relating to that in Infinite Jest, one of the characters finds that marijuana is no longer a pleasurable experience. It just makes him terribly self-conscious and therefore anxious. And I'm wondering what happens to you when you do something that's supposed to give you pleasure and that just makes you uncomfortable or anxious.
Boy, I'm not really even sure how to respond to that. Look, a lot of the impetus for writing Infinite Jest was just the fact that I was about 30 and I had a lot of friends who were about 30 and we'd all, you know, been grotesquely overeducated and privileged our whole lives and had better health care and more money than our parents did, and we were all extraordinarily sad. I think it has something to do with being raised in an era when really the ultimate value seems to be, I mean, a successful life is, let's see, you make a lot of money and you have a really attractive spouse or you get infamous or famous in some way, so that it's a life where you basically experience as much pleasure as possible, which ends up being sort of empty and low calorie. The reason I don't like talking about it discursively is it sounds very banal and cliche, you know, when you say it out loud that way. Believe it or not, this came as something of an epiphany to us at around age 30, sitting around talking about why on earth we were so miserable when we'd been so lucky.
Well, when did you realize that all the benefits you had in an educated middle-class life weren't bringing you happiness?
Well, I guess it sort of depends on what you mean by happiness. I mean, it's not like we were walking around fingering razor blades or anything like that, but it just sort of seems as if we sort of knew how happy our parents were, and we would compare our lives with our parents and see that at least on the surface or according to the criteria that the culture lays down for a successful, happy life, we were actually doing better than a lot of them were. And so why on earth were we so miserable? I don't mean to suggest that it was, you know, a state of constant clinical depression or that we all felt that we were supposed to be blissfully happy all the time. There was just I have a very weird and amateur sense that an enormous part of like my generation and the generation right after mine is just an extremely sad sort of lost generation, which when you think about the material comforts and the political freedoms that we enjoy is just strange.
In your novel, Infinite Jest, you deal with the pursuit of entertainment and pleasure. In fact, Infinite Jest is the title of a movie within the novel. You want to tell us a little bit about that movie?
Well, the movie, I guess, is sort of the MacGuffin of the book. I guess the idea is a lot of the book is about a kind of art film director who eventually comes up with a film that's so entertaining that anybody who watches it never wants to do anything else. Then the interesting thing becomes, if such a thing exists, do you avail yourself of it or not? And various people wring their hands about various elements of that question, but that's part of what the book's about.
Do you think there are other new forms of pleasure that people pursue in the novel?
Well, I think, and it's not much of a coincidence, I think a lot of the people in the book are at about, you know, the situation that I was in when I was starting to work on the book, which were people who not only were vaguely unhappy in certain ways, but they sensed a kind of incongruity about why they were unhappy and were beginning to wonder what values and assumptions were leading them to be unhappy, and then facing the rather unpleasant fact that there's very little to replace those in this culture, if that makes any sense at all.
What are those that you're referring to?
Well, I guess the basic idea that I feel lame saying it out loud. I mean, it sounds like I'm Bill Bennett or something. I guess the basic idea that the purpose of life is to be happy, or is to experience the most favorable ratio of pleasure to suffering, or productivity to work, mm-hmm. or gratification to sacrifice, or any of that stuff. Which, you know, a couple generations ago, to say that kind of stuff would have made you, you know, a freak and an Epicurean, and now seems to be so much simply an unquestioned assumption of the culture that we don't really even talk about it anymore. I'm certainly starting to perspire talking about it here, because I'm afraid it sounds very, you know, it sounds like I'm going to walk out of the room with my knuckles dragging on the ground.
One of your essays in your new collection is about irony and how it's become the common language of TV and a lot of contemporary fiction. You talk about how television has institutionalized hip irony. Can I ask you to explain what you mean by that?
What sort of time limit is there? No, I mean, the essay is really about the relation between TV and fiction and what it's like to be a fiction writer who watches a lot of TV. And I guess the basic point is that a lot of the tools that were used by literary fiction writers in, I guess, particularly the 60s to help, oh, if there was a social agenda, I think it was probably to debunk certain kind of hypocritical, word-cleaverish assumptions that the culture was making about itself. Those techniques, including meta-discursive stuff, self-reference, irony, black humor, cynicism, grotesquerie, and shock, that what's interesting now is now that really television, I think it would be safe to say that television or televisual values rule the culture. Television is now successfully using a lot of those same techniques, but using them for a very, very different agenda, which is to sort of create an ethos and please people and to sell products to consumers. So that the essay is supposed to be a setup for, so what is the literary rebel or the writer who wants to be engaged somehow with the culture do now? You know, how do you be a rebel when Burger King, you know, for 2 years their slogan was, you got to break the rules. How do you rebel against anarchy or a kind of weird crafted anarchy?
You write about how irony can become not only tiresome but even tyrannical. What are some of the problems you see with the ironic voice, whether you're a viewer watching television or a writer using it in your fiction or essays?
Well, a vivid example to use right now is how I feel in here answering some of the questions you were asking about pleasure. The beads of perspiration I get on my forehead talking about something like, does my generation face a task in terms of exploring what values we want to live our lives by, or what we think the purpose of our life is and how much is pleasure a part of it? I'm so terrified of sounding like Bill Bennett or, you know, Church Lady, who's been parodied on Saturday Night Live, or, God forbid, Stuart Smalley, who's been parodied on Saturday Night Live, that this entire how to talk straight about anything that really means anything, that might sound cliche, that might sound uncool, might sound unhip. I mean, there's an absolute terror that goes along with it. And I know, because most of my friends are my age and younger, that this is not just me, that there is some weird way that if the greatest sin in the past was, you know, obscenity or shock, the greatest sin now is appearing naive or old-fashioned so that somebody can give you a sort of a very cool arch smile and devastate you with one extraordinarily crafted line that puts kind of a hole in your pretentious balloon.
Now, is that a problem for you as a writer? Do you feel that there are certain sentiments, certain like heartfelt sentiments that you're afraid to deal with because it might sound square and corny?
Well, it's more complicated than that, because usually if you're writing fiction, you're dealing with characters who themselves will have heartfelt sentiments, but who themselves live in this culture right now and thus face all the impediments to sort of dealing with those parts of their lives that, you know, that we do. So it would be not only silly but unrealistic to have a character saying that kind of stuff. I don't know. I mean, other writers with whom I talk about this stuff, it's more just this a lot of writers are tired of doing kind of hip, slick, funny, dark, exploding hypocrisy, underlining once again the point that life is a farce and we're all in it for ourselves, and that the point of life is to amass as much money slash fame slash sexual gratification, you know, whatever your personal thing is, and that everything else is just glitter or PR image, that we're tired of sort of doing that stuff over and over and over again. Yet to do stuff that flies in the face of that is to risk becoming the Bridges of Madison County guy. Mm-hmm, I mean, a lot of the stuff that would seem on the surface of it to counteract that is gooey, hideous, horrible, retrograde, cynical stuff, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, well, I think it's just like very perceptive of you to put your finger on the limitations of like the need for irony, but at the same time the limitations of irony.
Irony, as far as I could see, and you know, you can take college courses for 3 years on just what irony is. So there's something. I guess I'm going to assume that everybody kind of knows. When David Letterman comes out and draws himself up to his full height and says, "What a fine crowd," you know, echoing the Arthur Godfrey of decades past. That's the kind of thing that I mean. Irony and sarcasm and all that stuff are fantastic for exploding hypocrisy and exposing what's wrong in extant values. As far as I can see, they're notably less good at erecting replacement values or coming any closer to the truth. And the thing about it is they're a terrific tool and they were used really well. We're just still using it, it seems to me, as a culture 35, 40 years after it really had some use.
Did you watch a lot of TV now?
I actually do not own a TV now, but that is not TV's fault. It's my fault, because if I own it, I will watch it. And, you know, even when after an hour or so, I'm not even enjoying watching it because I'm feeling guilty at how non-productive I'm being, except the feeling guilty then makes me anxious, which I want to soothe by distracting myself. So I'll watch the TV even more. And it just gets, I don't know, it just gets depressing. My own relationship to TV depresses me. It's not TV per se. I do have a VCR, so it's not like I never watch a cathode ray screen.
So when did you start realizing that in order to not watch TV, you couldn't even own a TV?
I was sick in bed one day and decided I would amuse myself by drawing up a list of all the things I thought would be neat to read or that I should have read and that I had not read. And by the time I was on the 12th page, I began to panic and to realize that I needed to start doing some reading, and that if there was a TV in the room, I found out about a month later, I would simply, I mean, the game I'll play with myself is, oh, I'll read it with the TV on, which is just a farce. So I just decided I had too much to read to be able to own a TV.
Something else you write about really well is self-consciousness. You write, for instance, about how writers are often bystanders, almost like voyeurs, and they're really good at watching other people, but they hate to be watched themselves and tend to be very self-conscious. Now, I know you don't want to overgeneralize, and this isn't true of all writers, blah, blah, blah.
Well, I'm happy to overgeneralize.
It's certainly true of a lot of writers.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I've said this before on Fresh Air, I think self-conscious narrators make the best narrators because they're self-conscious about every detail, every action they're making, and they're registering everybody else's action.
I think there's a certain kind of neurological makeup that goes along with being a writer, and having been in the room with a few other writers at the same time, it's rather wearing to be around. And it does, there is a kind of hypervigilance about it. Unfortunately, it's got disadvantages. If you turn that hypervigilance on yourself, and for instance, you know, whether or not you have a pimple on the end of your nose, I mean, it can get really depressing. It's also something of a continuum, and self-consciousness up to a point is really useful and really helpful, but I don't know how many people want to read a thing, you know, about self-consciousness of self-consciousness or self-consciousness of that, and it you can really kind of get in this infalling trap.
One of the characters in Infinite Jest is a tennis player, and you were a champion tennis player when you were.
I was not. I deny.
Okay, not champion.
I deny steadfastly that I was a champion. I played competitive tennis on a regional junior level.
You were.
I was not a champion, and I don't want anybody from my hometown to hear me profess the word champion.
You were a darned good tennis player.
I was decent by competitive standards.
Okay, good. And this is when you were about what, age 12 to 15?
Something like that, yeah.
Now, did all your self-consciousness interfere with your performance on the court?
This is a marvelous setup. Well, of course. I mean, this is one of the great mysteries about athletes, and why I think they appear dumb to some of us, is that they seem to have this ability to turn off. I don't know how many of your listeners have this part in their brain, but what if I double fault on this point? Or what if I miss this free throw? Or what if I don't get this strike with the entire bowling team, you know, hanging on? The professional athletes and great athletes, at first I thought it was that stuff doesn't occur to them, but But, you know, when I hung out with the pro tennis player for the tennis essay, it occurred to me that it's more like they have some sort of muscle that can cut that kind of thinking off. But that is literally paralyzing. You can end up like a bunny, you know, with in the headlights of an oncoming car if you do that to yourself enough.
Did you have that ability to turn it off?
No. And that is I was a middlingly talented athlete, but my big problem, and the coach told me at age 13, kid, you got a bad head. And what he meant was I would choke. I would begin thinking about, oh, no, what if this happens? And then I would say, well, shut up. Don't think about it. And then I would say to myself, but how can I not think about it if I'm not thinking about it? And meanwhile, you know, I'm standing drooling on the baseline going through this whole not very interesting game of mental ping pong while the other guy is briskly going about the business of winning the match.
Well, David Foster Wallace, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you back.
My interview with the late David Foster Wallace was recorded in 1997, 1 year after the new film about him is set. In the film, The End of the Tour, he's portrayed by Jason Segel. Jesse Eisenberg plays David Lipsky, the Rolling Stone journalist who accompanies Wallace on the end of his book tour, interviewing him every step of the way. Here they are at a diner.
You know what I would love to do, man? I would love to do a profile on one of you guys who's doing a profile on me.
Mm. That is interesting.
Or is that too pomo and cute? I don't know.
Maybe for Rolling Stone, but
it would be interesting, though.
You think?
I'm sorry, man.
What's wrong?
It's just you're going to go back to New York and, like, sit at your desk and shape this thing however you want. That, I mean, to me, it's just extremely disturbing.
Why is it disturbing?
Because I think I would like to shape the impression of me that's coming across.
I see.
Yeah.
I
don't even know if I like you yet. So nervous about whether you like me.
Here you go. Your food will be out soon. Can I get you anything else?
No, we're fine. Thank you.
Thanks. What's this story about in your mind? What does Jan want?
Just what it's like to be the most talked about writer in the country or that that sort of thing.
We'll hear my 2009 interview with Jason Segel after a break. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This episode of Fresh Air and the following message come from SimpliSafe Home Security, the smart way to protect your home or small business. SimpliSafe is a wireless system with no annual contracts and around-the-clock protection. It's never been easier to make your home safe. Tech experts at CNET call SimpliSafe better, smarter home security. You can try this wireless alarm system, get a 10% discount, and show support for this show by visiting SimpliSafe. That's SimpliSafe.com/fresh air.
After hearing an archive interview with David Foster Wallace, we thought you'd enjoy hearing an interview with Jason Segel, who portrays Wallace in the new film The End of the Tour. Segel started his career alongside Seth Rogen and James Franco, portraying high school students in the TV series Freaks and Geeks. Segel went on to star in such films as Forgetting Sarah Marshall, Bad Teacher, and The Muppets, and he starred in the TV series How I Met Your Mother. This interview with Jason Segel was recorded in 2009. Let's talk a little bit about a film that you wrote and star in, and that's Forgetting Sarah Marshall, which I missed in the movies, but I watched it on DVD. It's out on DVD, and it's really good, and it's really funny.
Oh, thanks.
Let's hear what I know is your most famous scene in the movie, and this is from the beginning of the film. you play a guy who writes music for a crime scene kind of TV show.
Exactly. It's basically a CSI spoof. I was a guest star on CSI for a while, and I just always found how serious it all is very funny. So I play a guy who composes the music and is sort of just dying inside because he wants to be a proper musician. And his girlfriend is the star of the show. And so one day she comes over to the house, and I think she's there to have sex with me. So I'm waiting there naked for her. And she proceeds to dump me while I'm naked.
Yeah, well, let me just explain it a little bit more. She told you that she's coming over, and you didn't expect her that quickly, so you jump into the shower, and you come out with a towel wrapped around you, surprised to find her there. And as she tells you the news, the towel drops, and we get to see you full top to bottom from front and behind.
Yes.
Fully naked.
You're welcome.
Yes, right. So here's the scene.
Peter, as you know, I love you very much.
Are you breaking up with me?
Pete. Are you,
I just need a minute.
Okay.
Please don't go.
Why don't you just put on some clothes and we can sit down and discuss
No,
this.
I can't do anything right now.
I'm so sorry, Pete.
I'm in love with you.
Why don't you just put some clothes on, okay?
I'm not going to go put clothes on. I know what that means. If I put clothes on, it's over.
Okay, so my guest Jason Segel with Kristen Bell from his film Forgetting Sarah Marshall. Now,
that was taken from the pages of real life. I once got dumped while I was naked. But she asked me to put clothes on during this real breakup, my real life breakup. And as opposed to in the movie when I say no, I did go to put clothes on. So she waited for me while I went back into my room to get dressed. Let me just tell you, Terry.
Yeah.
Picking out an outfit for the second half of a breakup is like the hardest outfit you'll ever pick out in your life. I came out in a blue button-up shirt and khaki pants like I was going to private school.
So did it seem funny to you at the time, or is it just in retrospect that these things take
no,
on?
No, you know what? And I think maybe this is the mind of a writer, I guess. It was while this breakup is happening, which was probably the most significant moment of my life to date, you know, when that happened. And I'm naked. And the whole time I'm thinking, this is really, really funny. I'm going to use this in a movie someday. And slowly her voice became like the teacher from Charlie Brown. You know, just wah, 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 while I was slowly constructing the scene in my mind.
Oh, so what did she say? What did the real ex-girlfriend say when she saw the movie?
Amazingly, we don't speak anymore.
Oh, shocking. Right. Okay.
Yes.
I should have seen that coming.
Yeah.
So, like, you're 6'4", I think?
I am 6'4".
So when you're naked, there's a lot of you to see. And it makes it even funnier because you have, like, there's such a big body there that's...
Yeah.
That's, like, dwarfing your girlfriend.
I know. Well, you know, part of what I thought could be great, and I think it did turn out really well, is, you know, I know it's a comedy and so everything has to be funny, but I didn't want that breakup scene to be funny. I didn't want it to be played for laughs, you know, because I think it was a really important part of the movie, this that the breakup be as painful as possible. So I thought the backdrop of me being naked gave me the opportunity to play the scene totally seriously, because every time you cut back to me naked, you're going to get a laugh, you know? And the other thing I thought was I wanted it to be a guy literally at his most vulnerable. And so, you know, I think naked is about as vulnerable as it gets. And the final thing is I hate romantic comedies for the reason that you always know how it's going to end. The guy's going to end up with the girl. Like, hey, probably that girl has been really nice to him the whole movie, who works at the cookie shop, you know. You can tell what's about to happen. And so I've always been reticent to go. And I thought, as a viewer – if in the very first scene of the movie your lead actor is suddenly full frontal, you know, naked, you're forced to sort of throw out your expectations and sit back and say, I don't know what's going to happen in this movie, you know? So I think it sort of set the stage to lose any preconceptions about what the movie might be like.
What did your mother say about the scene?
Oh, man. I still regret this moment. I thought it would be a funny joke not to tell my mother I had done it and have her find out at the first showing of the movie. So
you didn't tell her? Is that what you're saying? You did not tell her?
Yes. Okay. I did not tell her that I had done it. And I walk her into the first screening, and all of a sudden I walk out and I drop my towel and I'm naked. And I look over at my father, and my father's laughing hysterically. I look at my little sister is laughing hysterically. And then I turn and I looked at my mom, and she was staring at me with a tear streaming down her face. And she said, "Why didn't you tell me?" And I said, I thought it would be a funny joke not to tell you. And then she said, "This is not a funny joke." And that was the last we spoke of it.
We're listening back to my 2009 interview with Jason Segel. He plays David Foster Wallace in the new film, The End of the Tour. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast comes from the new Starz original comedy Blunt Talk, starring Patrick Stewart as Walter Blunt, a British import intent on conquering the world of American cable news. That is, if network bosses, a dysfunctional news staff, and misguided decision-making don't derail his mission first. Don't miss the series premiere Saturday, August 22nd, only on Stars.
No, this is another thing from Forgetting Sarah Marshall. The character that you play in it, the main character, is working on a rock opera with puppets about Dracula and eternal love.
Yes.
And I've read that you were actually or are actually working on a similar musical, yes?
I am, yeah. Well, the way that wasn't written for the movie, that Dracula musical. Sadly, I had a really bad out-of-work period from like 21 to 25. I couldn't figure out what I was going to do with my life because I didn't have a college education. And I thought I was going to have to like live with my parents for the rest of my life. Looking back, I was such an arrogant kid. I thought the two options for me were either movie star or live with my parents, get a real job. Like never entered my mind. But so I thought the way that I could jumpstart my career was to write a Dracula musical to be done with puppets, but I was writing it without a sense of irony. It wasn't a comedy. It was going to be like a slow, labored drama. So anyway, I finally finished a few of the songs, and I took it to Judd Apatow to play for him. He's the first person I played it for. And the first song starts, and about halfway through, he pushes stop on the CD player, and he looks at me and goes, "Jace, just take my advice. You can't ever play this for anyone, ever." And thank God I didn't, because I would have looked like a crazy person, and I got to save it for the movie.
Well, you know, in Forgetting Sarah Marshall, your character doesn't realize that the Dracula musical he's writing is really a comedy.
Yeah, and straight from the pages of real life.
Right, okay. Well, how did you realize it? Because of Judd Apatow?
Yeah. Yeah, basically.
But he didn't say it was funny. He just said, never let anybody hear this.
No, he said never let anyone hear it. And I'll tell you how it ended up happening. Judd has the same feelings about romantic comedies I do, specifically how hard it is to come up with an original ending, you know? And so we were sitting around brainstorming, like, what could be an original ending for a romantic comedy? And I looked at him half joking, and I said, well, we could always use my Dracula musical. And he looked at me, and it was like, you know, Judd Apatow is a comedy genius. And you just saw like, ding, you saw this look in his eyes like, oh, my God, that's weird enough that it might work. So I just rewrote it that night that my character has been secretly working on a Dracula opera. And that's how that happened.
Well, I want to play a scene that relates to this. And this is a scene where you're at a bar with a girl who you hope is becoming your new girlfriend.
Yes.
And she's asked the band – she knows you're working on this Dracula rock opera. So she's asked the band to call you on stage and invite you to perform an excerpt of the Dracula musical. And you go very reluctantly to the stage and with great discomfort start to play one of the songs. And at this point, you still think it's a serious musical, and it's not until she laughs – that you realize, oh, it's a comedy. So here's that scene in which you're playing an excerpt of your Dracula rock opera.
It's getting kind of hard to believe things are going to get better. I've been drowning too long to believe that the tide's going to turn. And I've been living too hard to believe things are going to get easier now. I'm still trying to shake off the pain from the lessons I've learned. And if I see Van Helsing, I swear to the Lord I will slay him. Ha 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 ha! He'd take you from me, but I swear I won't let it be so. Ha 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 ha! Blood will run down his face when he is decapitated. His head on my mantle is how I will let this world know how much I love you. Die. I can't.
Oh.
I'm such a weirdo.
That's Jason Segel in an excerpt of his film Forgetting Sarah Marshall, which is on DVD. You know, in that die, I can't. No. You just kind of capture very succinctly there the downside of immortality.
Absolutely.
Vampire's face.
Yeah, I think I understand why women never want to stay with me. Imagine I'm out of work and I'm sitting there writing that song till all hours of the morning.
What are some of the like musicals or rock operas that have influenced you and made you want to write one of your own?
Oh man, well, I used to see Les Miserables with my family every year when I was young, and I just loved it. I loved it so much, to the point where when I was about 7 years old or so, I was finally old enough to go to my brother's sleepaway camp. And I was so excited because, you know, I really looked up to my brother. And my brother really didn't like me that much at this age. Like, I would embarrass him a lot. I wore a Superman cape under my clothes, for example.
Did you really?
I did, until I was way too old, until I was like 10 years old. But so anyway, I was going to finally get to go to camp with him. And he said, Jason, let me tell you something. This is my camp. I love it. You're not going to embarrass me, okay? And I was petulant. I said, of course, I'm not going to embarrass you, Adam. Jeez. So first day at camp, we're sitting there, and the counselor gets up, and he says, all right, well, we'd like to welcome everybody back, and we'd also like to welcome the new campers. As a matter of fact, would anybody like to do an impromptu talent show? And I see my brother look at me like, you better not, kid. And little Jason Segel raises his hand, slowly makes his way up to the stage, in a Superman cape, and I get to the front, and he says, all right, what would you like to do? And I said, I'd like to sing. And I started singing, there is a castle on a cloud. I sang the little girl song from Les Miserables from beginning to end. My brother was mortified.
No, I read that you went to Catholic school, although you're Jewish. Is that true?
Yeah, I was the only Jewish kid at this all-Christian school, and that was a little weird. I remember this one moment where I sent out my bar mitzvah invitations to everybody, and the principal came up and said, listen, Jason, everyone's really excited, but I don't think that the kids know what a bar mitzvah is. I was wondering if maybe you wanted to explain at communion what a bar mitzvah is. Now, keep in mind, these kids are already jumping on my back saying, ride the oaf. So 12-year-old Jason Segel walks to the front of communion and has to stand in front of these kids and go, on Saturday, I become a man. Nothing gets you beat up faster than the line, on Saturday, I become a man.
Oh, that's so great. So how old were you when you knew you wanted to be an actor, and how did you know? Well, it sounds like you knew all along, actually, with the Superman outfit and singing at your brother's summer camp.
Well, I think the seeds were there. My parents had put me into an acting class when I was about 9 or 10 or so, because I was having such a hard time at that school making friends, that they wanted to send me someplace that was not religiously affiliated at all, you know? So they sent me to this acting class, but it was more about not being shy than it was about acting. I got started in a really weird way. I had just won a state championship playing basketball in California, and my brother was a great basketball player, and I sort of wanted to play college ball. That's what I figured I would do. But I had this art history class that I found very boring. And so it was right next to the drama department. And every day on the way to art history class, I would reach in real quick to the drama department and grab a play. And I would read it during class. And I read one called The Zoo Story by Edward Albee. And there was a 40-minute monologue in it. And I thought, I'd like to try this just to see if I could do it. You know, it's a two-man play. So I found a guy to do the play with me, and I asked the head of the drama department if he minded if I put on this play. And he said, no problem. So I did it, and he came up to me after, and he said, look, I think you're really good at this, and you might want to consider becoming an actor. And I said, no, I'm going to play college basketball. And I was kind of a jock at this point. And he said, well, do me a favor. I'm teaching a mock audition class on Saturday. Will you come and just see if you like it? So I said, sure. So I show up at this mock audition class, and I go in, and it's him and this lady. And they have me do like half an hour of reading like sides blind. And I did them, and I left, and they said, thank you very much. A week later, my parents sat me down and said, we've been talking to Paramount Pictures all week. He didn't want to tell you, but that was the president of casting at Paramount, and he had set up a fake audition for me.
Oh, you're kidding.
And he didn't want me to be nervous, so he just told me it was a mock audition class. And Paramount was in touch with my parents all week, and next thing I knew, I had an agent and manager, and I started working my senior year of high school. So it was crazy. It sort of found me, you know?
Jason Segel, it's been so much fun talking with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks.
Jason Segel recorded in 2009. He plays writer David Foster Wallace in the new movie, The End of the Tour. Coming up, David Bianculli reviews a new HBO miniseries from David Simon, who created The Wire and Tremé. That's after a break. This is Fresh Air. Before we get back to Fresh Air, here's another podcast you might enjoy, the TED Radio Hour. You'll hear discussions about fascinating ideas, amazing inventions, fresh approaches to old problems, and new ways to think and create. You can find the TED Radio Hour podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. For the next three Sundays, HBO presents Show Me a Hero, the latest TV drama from that network by David Simon, creator of The Wire and Tremé. Show Me a Hero is based on a true story and stars Oscar Isaac as a rising young politician in Yonkers, New York, in the late 1980s. Our TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
By now, viewers know what to expect from a David Simon drama. You expect an intense study of a precise location, as with Baltimore in The Wire and New Orleans in Tremé. You expect flawed, fascinating, and unforgettable characters, like Omar in The Wire, just to name one. And you expect the story to raise issues, especially about race and politics, that are unfortunately relevant to today. Show Me a Hero, a 6-hour miniseries presented by HBO over 3 weeks, checks off all those boxes. It's based on Lisa Belkin's nonfiction book of the same name, which examined events and emotions over a heated political issue in a specific time and place. The time is the late 1980s. The place, Yonkers, New York, and the issue is public housing. The city had been found guilty of building all of its government-mandated public housing units in poor black neighborhoods and was ordered to build new ones in more affluent areas. Many white Yonkers residents rose up in anger, making the housing issue central to the local election. Into that heated battle steps an ambitious young politician, Nick Wasisco, played by Oscar Isaac from Inside Llewyn Davis. David Simon and Show Me a Hero co-creator William F. Zorzi, who contributed to The Wire, approach this complicated piece of history by coming at it from several illuminating angles. We get to know council members, judges, lawyers, newspaper reporters, but we also see the housing issue from the points of view of citizen activists, low-income housing residents, and other street-level perspectives. The same goes for Isaac's character of Nick Wasisco, who decides to run for mayor of Yonkers against the local incumbent. We see him in contentious public and private meetings, but we also see his very human side when he gives a ride home to a young secretary who works in the same government building. She's played by Carla Cavedo. As he drops her off, he leans in and plants an unexpected kiss, then reacts to himself after she leaves.
Thanks for the lift.
Yeah, no problem. You know, it's on the way to the Italian-American Forum tonight, so...
Every night's some other event, huh?
Yeah, well...
It's crazy.
I know. If you want to be the mayor, you got to work at it, right?
Yeah.
And, well, don't tell anybody, but I always wanted to be the mayor.
Really?
Yeah. It's true. I swear, I used to talk about it all the time growing up. The other kids used to call me the mayor.
Really?
It wasn't a compliment. But, you know, I try to take it as one.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. All right. I better go in. My parents will worry about me.
Yeah, okay.
Have a good night, okay?
All right, yeah. It's just...
That was weird.
Was it?
I just... You kind of caught me off guard. I better go in now.
We should talk.
Yeah, okay. So Monday.
Okay.
All right, bye.
Good night.
Yeah, good night.
In public, Nick is a lot more reserved, at least at first. He's surrounded by people with more power, played by actors who fill their roles aggressively. Winona Ryder, Alfred Molina, Jim Belushi, Bob Balaban, Peter Riegert, LaTanya Richardson, and Catherine Keener all make strong impressions here. And no one makes a stronger impression than Oscar Isaac in the leading role. Virtually every character in Show Me a Hero has his or her good and bad times, but only Isaac's Nick seems to take it all so personally. The drama's title comes from the F. Scott Fitzgerald quote, "Show me a hero, and I'll write you a tragedy." And the title fits. Show Me a Hero is directed by Paul Haggis, the writer-director of Crash, whom TV fans may remember as the man behind the underrated quality classics Due South and Easy Streets. His visual touch and taste are evident here, and he's also a good fit with Simon because he frames scenes in a way that expects, almost demands, that attention must be paid. Early on in the first episode, here's a behind-closed-door meeting about the housing issue, presided over by Jim Belushi's mayor. Also present, among others, are local politicians played by Winona Ryder and by Oscar Isaac.
200 units and 4 possible sites. It's not the end of the world, guys. We spread it around. No district is more than one site. No site is more than 50 or so units.
I'm thinking maybe we double the number of proposed housing sites.
8 sites means less units in any one neighborhood. Less anger from voters. We spread the pain thinner.
Oh, we dump all of them in Spallone's district either way.
Like I said, it's better to be on the inside when a deal goes down. I'm asking you all to be co-sponsors. I'm not going to bother with Spallone and them. We know how they stand.
Christ, an election year.
Tell me about it.
Thank
Look,
you.
I know you guys would rather do nothing and let the judge pick the sites himself, but the judge ain't buying that. He put it on us.
I can't be a co-sponsor. I just can't have my name on it.
Come on, Frank.
Yeah, but you can vote for it, right? Or Angela put 3 of the 8 sites in your district.
Look, I understand complying and that the law is the law, but what about our appeal?
We should have never appealed in the first place. Not a chance in hell they'll overturn Sand.
But we're still paying the lawyers to carry it to the Second Circuit, so if you want to tell the voters you're fighting it in the courts, you can.
Honestly, guys, I think this is the only responsible option we have. You think about it over lunch and I want a yes.
You'll need to pay attention to get all the nuances packed into this miniseries, but it's worth it. At a time when racial tensions and blustery politicians are dominating headlines, this 25-year-old true story couldn't seem more timely. Or, since it presents some actual solutions to political posturing and deep-seated racial hostilities, more valuable.
David Bianculli is the founder and editor of the online magazine TV Worth Watching and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. On the next Fresh Air...
Caption, I leapt out of the closet. And 4 months later, my father killed himself by stepping in front of a truck.
We'll talk about the Tony Award-winning musical Fun Home with Alison Bechdel, who wrote the memoir it's based on, and with the show's songwriters, Lisa Krohn and Janine Tesori. I hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.